Hello and welcome to the reading of the Council Bus Daily Nonpareil on this Friday, January 29th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. I am your reader, Wally Helms. Let's look at the front page story at the very top. Tim Johnson and Aaron Murphy report the headline, In-Person Education Makes Way Through Legislature. The Iowa legislature appeared poised Thursday to pass a bill to require all schools to offer a full-time in-person option for students. Senate Study Bill 1064, introduced by Senator Amy Sinclair, Republican Allerton, chair of the Senate Education Committee, would require Iowa's public and non-public accredited schools to provide a 100% in-person instruction option for parents and students. However, it would still allow a waiver process via the State Department of Education to adapt to public health and staffing conditions if a district is hit with a viral outbreak. The state would consider the positivity rate in the county where the school district is located, the number of teachers out to quarantine, and the supply of substitute teachers and bus drivers in deciding whether to approve the waiver, the bill states. Districts could continue to offer hybrid and virtual options in addition to the full-time option, Sinclair said. St. Albert Catholic School is completely in support of full-time, in-person instruction, President Ann Rowling said. In fact, St. Albert opened its doors for the 2020-2021 school year in person and never looked back, she said. We feel it is best for children educationally and for their emotional and mental health to be on-site. We implemented appropriate safety measures and have remained diligent about keeping them in place. Although Lewis Central Community School District has also been holding full-time in-person school throughout the school year, Superintendent Eric Nost has a different point of view. I think those decisions should be left to the local elected boards of education, who are much more closely connected to their school communities than those residing at the state capitol, he said. This should be a matter of local control. Republicans, including Reynolds, support the proposal, saying students and families should have the option of being in the classroom full-time during the COVID-19 pandemic, even in districts where local school and public health officials have not deemed that to be safe. Senator Dan Dawson, Republican Council Bluffs, said last week that while he supports local control, unfortunately, this past fall we had extremely bad actors. I would point to the Des Moines Public Schools. The Des Moines district maintained virtual-only instruction for most of the year, despite directives from Reynolds. Dawson said he thinks students, especially elementary school students, need an in-person option. Democrats oppose the measure, saying local leaders, not state lawmakers, know best how to operate their schools with staffs and students' education and safety in mind. State House Democrats argued that everyone is in agreement that students should be in Iowa's classrooms, but added that it should be handled safely and at the discretion of local leaders. Is there a single person in Iowa that believes kids should not be in school right now? Do you know of anyone who thinks that? But forcing kids back in the middle of an uncontrolled global pandemic is dangerous, said Senator Joe Bolcom, Democrat, Iowa City. During the COVID-19 pandemic, some schools have operated either entirely online or by using a hybrid model, in which students are in classrooms some days and learn virtually other days. The proposed legislation would require those districts to also permit any students who wish to attend school in person every day. During debate on the proposal in the Iowa Senate, Democrats read correspondence from school administrators, nurses, and teachers who suggested the measure would put school staff and students in danger. The legislation passed the Senate on a party-line vote with 29 Republicans supporting and 18 Democrats opposing. It was scheduled to be debated later Thursday in the Iowa House, where it was also expected to pass with the Republican majority there. It had not passed as of press time. The bill would then be sent to Reynolds, who in recent weeks has pushed strongly for the proposal. The measure would take effect no later than the second Monday after enactment and would be in effect until June 30, the end of the current fiscal year. Parents and students would be given at least 5 days to decide what kind of instruction they wish to receive, according to legislation. And the article mentions at the end that Murphy is with the Lee Des Moines Bureau and contributed from Des Moines. Another front page article, also written by Aaron Murphy of the Lee Des Moines Bureau, State House Democrats call for more COVID-19 legislation. Just more than 2 weeks into the 2021 legislative session, State House Democrats are asking majority Republicans for the whereabouts of legislation to address the COVID-19 pandemic. During an online press conference Wednesday, State House Democratic leaders said Republicans, who hold majorities in the Iowa House and Senate and thus set the legislative agenda in both chambers, appear more interested in using the first weeks of the session to approve partisan legislation than work on proposals that would address the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Among the bills Republicans have run by this session are conservative-backed proposals for K-12 public education and proposed amendments to the Iowa Constitution with conservative-backed guidelines on abortion and gun rights and regulations. We came here to Des Moines to start this legislative session a few weeks ago in the middle of a pandemic, and to this point we haven't seen or really had any talk of doing legislation that helps Iowans get through the pandemic, said Charles City lawmaker Todd Pritchard, leader of the minority House Democrats. We're fast-tracking a lot of legislation that really doesn't deal with the pandemic or isn't helping working Iowans, regular Iowans, get through this pandemic. And we think that shows a lack of proper priorities. We'd like a focus of doing something for Iowans in this time of crisis with the pandemic. Representative Charlie McConkie, Council Bluffs Democrat, told the Nonpareil last week, "I don't think we're spending enough time on the pandemic. First of all, we have to deal with the pandemic. They're spending more time on guns, abortions, and death penalty," he said. "More CARES Act federal COVID relief money is coming through. We have to get that out fast." Democrats said they would like to see the advancement of the debate on legislation that would provide state funding to small businesses that have been impacted by the pandemic, proposals to create more affordable housing options, and proposals to allow more healthcare professionals to administer the COVID-19 vaccine. One such proposal, House Study Bill 71, proposed by the State Dental Board, would allow dentists to administer the vaccine. The proposal has not yet been considered by the House committee to which it was assigned. The bill can be found on the Iowa government webpage under legislation and bill and book so forth. You can search through and find that bill. That's the kind of legislation that we should be fast-tracking, legislation that would actually speed up the delivery of vaccine to get more shots into the arms of Iowans throughout our state, said Coralville lawmaker Zach Walls, leader of the minority state Democrats. That's the kind of legislation that we should be fast-tracking, not a radical defunding of Iowa's public education system. As of Wednesday, 11 unique legislative proposals had been introduced that contained the term COVID, according to an online search of legislation proposed during this year's session. Of those, 6 were introduced by Republicans. Of those, 3 are the conservative-supported K-12 public school measures. 1 would prevent public universities from requiring students to wear face masks off campus, and another would strip a percentage of funding from school districts that conducted online-only learning without an approved waiver from the state. The 6th Republican COVID-19 bill that would write in state law that pharmacists can administer the COVID-19 vaccine during the pandemic, that has already been cleared by the federal government. Jack Whitver, the Republican Senate Majority Leader from Ankeny, said it is appropriate for state lawmakers to first understand everything in federal COVID-19 relief packages, including a $900 billion package approved roughly a month ago, and more proposals coming for another round of federal relief. Whitfer also pointed to legislation passed during the pandemic, abbreviated 2020 session, which gave businesses an extra layer of legal protection from COVID-19 related lawsuits. The proposal was generally supported by Republicans and opposed by Democrats. When I talk to small business owners, the number one issue they bring up is being able to responsibly run their businesses without fear of litigation. To address that need, we passed the gold standard for litigation protection at the end of 2020 session, Whitmer said in an emailed statement. We continue to work ensuring their businesses can stay open and the owners can earn a living for themselves and their employee. It's mentioned at the end that Nonpareil News editor Mike Brownlee contributed to the report, and there is a picture on the front page of, Representative, I think it's a Representative McConkie. And staying with some legislative news, we have Mike Brownlee reporting area's first legislative coffee today. The first virtual legislative coffee hosted by the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce will be held today. The Zoom event will run from noon to 1 p.m., the Chamber President and CEO Drew Kemp moderating, according to the Chamber. The 2021 legislative coffee session will be held over Zoom. Additional events are planned on February 26, March 26, and April 30. Registration is required. Go to councilbluffsiowa.com for more information. That's for the recurring areas legislative coffees presented on Zoom. At the bottom of the front page, we have a story by Tim Johnson. New company, let me see if I get it right. New company may take over Bluffs Airport operations. A Davenport company is poised to acquire Advanced Air and become the new fixed base operator at the Council Bluffs Municipal Airport. The Council Bluffs Airport Authority is currently negotiating a long-term lease agreement with Carver Aero of Davenport based on its proposed investment in facilities and aviation services at the airport as presented in its statement of qualifications. The board selected Carver Aero from several other reputable FBO operators to begin negotiations on a long-term relationship at the airfield, said Andy Biller, executive director of the Council Bluffs Airport Authority. Carver plans to make our airport a magnet for our community and for a new breed of customers, as well as a trusted, nationally known place for a stopover and to refuel. Carver Aero and Advanced Air submitted a joint statement of qualifications on December 4th in response to a public request for qualifications process conducted by the Airport Authority, Biller said. At its December 16 board meeting, the board authorized an RFQ evaluation committee to begin negotiations with the most qualified respondent. At its January 20 meeting, the board approved a request by Advanced Air to be acquired by Carver Aero and have its fixed base operator lease with the airport authority assigned to Carver Aero, he said. The company reached an agreement to purchase Advanced Air from Lisa LaMantia, longtime owner-operator of the current FBO and flight school at the airport, according to a press release from Carver Aero. The board expects to reach an agreement with Carver Aero because of its, quote, proven engagement and commitment to job creation and workforce training, unquote, the press release stated. The board especially likes the company's established apprenticeship programs in cooperation with community colleges, Biller said. We are thankful for the trust of the Council Bluffs Airport Authority, having been selected to help to operate the FBO and to contribute to the growth of the airport and the community, said Peter Limburger, chairman of Carver Aero and co-founder and chairman CEO of CL Enterprises, the family holding company for Carver Aero. Coming to Council Bluffs will be the beginning of Carver Aero's expansion in the Midwest, Carver CEO Guy Leeser said in the press release. We want to bring that nostalgic sense of wonder back to the community airports, even make them the place where families come to enjoy watching planes take off and land, he said. We also believe airports should be major contributors to the local economy, and we are looking forward to becoming a part of the local and regional economic development efforts. Carver Aero believes there is a growing market for business customers and also for families who don't want to hassle with commercial airlines and the Transportation Security Administration anymore, the press release stated. We did a thorough study, and we are seeing an increase in charter services, partly because of COVID-19, but also because people want to fly out of their local airport on their own schedule, and with their family and pets, with land at an airport near their destination, and land there, Leeser said. Advanced Air's LaMantia said she is excited about the prospective growth of services in Council Bluffs, and said the acquisition of her company by Carver Aero will bring added professional and financial resources that will benefit aviators and wannabe aviators, according to the press release. We have the largest privately owned flight school in the Midwest, and Carver plans to expand that service, which will result in better paying careers, including for flight instructors, charter pilots, maintenance crews, and avionics technicians, she said. LaMantia will join Carver Aero and continue to oversee the Council Bluffs operations, according to the press release. The company recently purchased two more Beechcraft King Air turboprop airplanes and will base a King Air 200 and a King Air 350 in Council Bluffs to serve the eastern Nebraska and western Iowa market. The press release stated it has three King Air turboprops and several other aircraft based in Davenport. Carver Aero is hiring and recently added a new director of sales and marketing. Carver Aero has FBO operations in Davenport and Muscatine. The company provides corporate and general aviation services in Iowa, including charter flights, corporate pilot services, airplane maintenance, flight training, fuel services, and aircraft storage, and is aiming to capture growth in the charter industry. For more information, you can see the website Carver Aero, that's spelled that Aero is spelled AERO.com, CarverAero.com. The company is owned by CL Enterprises, which has its home office in Peru, Illinois, for businesses owned and managed by wife and husband Inga Karas and Peter Limburger. CEL invests in a variety of businesses from farming to manufacturing and from real estate development to aviation, with a focus on bringing economic development to smaller Midwestern towns. Both are avid pilots with the next goal to get rated to also fly helicopters. Limburger enjoys flying anything from gliders to aerobatics in an extra 330 and from their 1942 Stearman to more modern fighter jets. For more information, see CL-Enterprises.com. The article is accompanied by an aerial view of the Council Bluffs Air Municipal Airport. And the photo comes from the Omaha World Herald file, and the photographer was Chris McLaughlin. And in a related story on page 6, Tim Johnson reports insurance officials looking at airport fire. A fire that damaged a building and some aircraft and equipment at the Council Bluffs Municipal Airport late last year is still under investigation, mainly by insurance adjusters, a local official said. The blaze in Hangar D was reported at 6:41 a.m. on December 30 by a member of the airport staff, Council Bluffs Fire Marshal Alex Ford said after the incident. Three engines, two trucks, two rescue squads, and an assistant chief were dispatched to the scene, where they found heavy smoke coming from the maintenance end of the hangar. The airport was closed for about an hour, which is routine when emergency vehicles are working at the airport, Executive Director Andy Biller said. Besides the building, the fire damaged maintenance equipment and aircraft stored in the hangar's eight leased units. The Council Bluffs Fire Department determined that the fire was not suspicious in nature, but insurance adjusters want to pinpoint the cause and damages, Ford said. Since the airplanes have different owners, there are multiple insurance carriers involved. They want to determine the exact cause, he said. We think it was a mechanical problem in a Bobcat skid steer. They all want to send in their own experts. One plane was considered a total loss, and the others had varying amounts of smoke damage. But just how deeply the smoke penetrated and how much damage the smoke and heat caused is still being determined, Ford said. If they see evidence of damage, they might take it apart to see how much, Ford said. And that could take weeks or months, he said. And in the middle of the front page, we have a picture of a couple of, we have a speedboat, or maybe a, let's say a ski towing boat, and we also have one of those ski boats, as they appear on Lake Manawa State Park on July 21st. And the headline of the article says, Park It. With 3.2 million guests, Lake Manawa tops Iowa DNR list of most visited state parks in 2020. This is reported by Daniel Gehr of Iowa Watch. Daniel's name is spelled G-E-H-R. Daniel Gehr. A record 16.6 million visitors frequented Iowa state parks in 2020, according to data from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Iowans turned to the outdoors, with indoor activities interrupted or canceled by the coronavirus pandemic. Over the last decade, the Iowa DNR saw between 13.7 million and 15.5 million visitors to their state parks yearly. The system, with 83 parks and forests, recorded its 100th anniversary in 2020, just as the coronavirus came to Iowa in March. The Centers for Disease Control has recommended people remain 6 feet apart and meet outdoors to mitigate the spread of COVID-19, making spacious state parks popular destinations. Lake Manawa in Council Bluffs topped the list with an estimated 3.2 million visitors. Next came Gull Point near Mulford, Big Creek, Backbone, and Walnut Woods rounded out the top five. The parks still get plenty of use in the winter as the pandemic continues. Kirsten Egan and Tracy LaCroix of Council Bluffs walked January 17 around Lake Manawa with their dogs. This state park has been a way to get out of the house during the pandemic, LaCroix said. You can social distance outside, LaCroix said. It's really the only thing we could do all summer is go boating and just find things to do outdoors. Lake Manawa State Park, located in Council Bluffs, offers beach activities, fishing, and hiking, according to the Iowa DNR website. The Dream Playground, constructed in 2018, is the largest American Disabilities Act accessible playground in Iowa at 18,000 square feet, according to the Iowa DNR. How do state leaders know the number of visitors? They are an estimate, DNR Director of Communications Alex Murphy wrote in an email to Iowa Watch. Some parks use car counters, while others look at camping and rental use. Weather, events, construction, and visual observations also go into the estimate, Murphy said. Even during the winter, I think it's just beautiful out here, LaCroix said. Egan said she hopes the Iowa DNR will add camping to Lake Manawa. Gull Point State Park, located in the Iowa Great Lakes region, saw the second most visitors, 1.6 million, in 2020. The Lakeside Park offers camping, fishing, and 1.5 miles of self-guided trails for hiking. Of note, the August 10th derecho affected access to several parks and could have changed visitor numbers. The top 10 most visited parks by estimate are Lake Manawa, 3.2 million, Gull Point, 1.6 million, Big Creek, 721,265, Backbone, 637,500, Walnut Woods, 541,071, McIntosh Woods, 535,000, Black Hawk, 515,000, George Wyeth, 502,629, and Ledges, 492,321, and Lake McBride, 461,000. The source of those numbers is the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. LaCroix said her summer included many boat rides on Lake Manawa with friends and family. The frozen lake and snow-covered ground make her and Egan's January visits to Lake Manawa much different from the days of the park's highest visitation over the summer. And then there's a little note at the end. This project, Iowa State Parks, is a partnership between Iowa Watch, the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, and the Iowa Newspaper Foundation, with the goal of looking closely at one of Iowa's most valued resources, especially in the last year, the state park system. Iowa Watch, the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, is a nonpartisan, nonprofit news outlet that strives to be the state's leading collaborative investigative news organization. Read more at iowawatch.org. Iowa Watch and the INF will continue to partner on this series. On page 2, we have the regular feature face of the day, and that is Bron Glasnap. I'll spell his first name, B-R-A-H-N. Bron Glasnap has an open road ahead of him, but he has a few ideas as to what he wants to do with his future. Bron, 16, is a native of Council Bluffs. He attended Underwood Elementary School through his third grade year, before transferring to Heartland Christian School, where he is currently a sophomore. He has an older sister, Sophia, who is a senior at the school. Bron said it was definitely a shock going from a public school to a small private school, but he said he's loved his time at Heartland Christian ever since. Going from Underwood to here was a big change, but it was definitely well worth it, he said. With the staff and all of the students here, it's more like a family. You get a lot of one-on-one time with teachers, and everyone cares about you. You just know about everybody. Outside the classroom, Bron keeps busy with athletics, playing basketball and baseball. He's currently in the middle of hoops season and is looking forward to a road contest with the Cornerstone Christian School in Bellevue, Nebraska on Monday. Bron said he's glad that he's able to play sports after COVID-19 shut down spring sports last year. He said he was grateful that the state pulled off a baseball season last summer, and he's even more grateful to be playing sports this winter. Bron is quite the gearhead, and he has an affinity for working on automobiles. Older trucks are his specialty, and he drives a big 1976 Ford F-250. He said his love for machines may lead him to a career as a mechanic or something similar. When he wants to relax, Bron enjoys doing anything outdoors, from camping to hunting to fishing and more. Glasnap loves exploring nature. And the picture is, of course, of Bron Glasnap. He's wearing a black mask with a big blue H on it. He looks like he's wearing a black hoodie, and he's got brown hair and slightly squinting eyes. It's too bad they can't show them in their full face, but they all are pictured with masks, which is probably a good lesson. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on this Friday, January 29th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now, let's turn to today's obituary. Gerald Sorensen Jr. died on January 26th in Council Bluffs. No services are planned at this time, and it does not mention if there is any funeral home handling arrangements for the family. That's for Gerald Sorensen Jr. We have Julie Ann Frost, age 55, died January 25th in Danbury, Connecticut, after a lengthy illness. There are no services planned for Julie Ann Frost, who died in Danbury, Connecticut, at the age of 55 on January 25th. Jacqueline Joy Johnson, age 89, passed away January 28th in Council Bluffs. Open visitation Sunday, 12 noon to 4 p.m. Funeral services Monday, 11 a.m., all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral will be live streamed on funeral home website, interment Cedar Lawn Cemetery, memorials to the Cheryl K. Johnson Child Care Center at St. Albert, 400 Gleason Avenue, Council Bluffs, 51505. And that was for Jacqueline Joy Johnson, who died on January 28th in Council Bluffs at the age of 89. We have Rita May Kapurin Jones, 85, died on January 26th, and she has her services are planned for Saturday, 10:30 a.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church, private interment St. Joseph Cemetery, visitation starting at 9:30 a.m. at the church, Cutler O'Neill, Meyer Woodring, Funeral Home and Crematory, Bayless Park Chapel, handling arrangements for Rita May Kapurin Jones, who died on January 26th at the age of 85. We have Harry L. Beckner, age 83, passed away Tuesday, January 26th at Longview Nursing Home in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Visitation will be Saturday, January 30, from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Logan, Iowa. Funeral service Saturday, January 30, at 3 p.m. at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Logan. Burial will be held at a future date. Arrangements made by the Logan Funeral Chapel of Logan, Iowa. That's for Harry L. Beckner, who died at the Longview Nursing Home in Missouri Valley, Iowa, January 26th, at the age of 83. And now we turn to the sports page for some prep basketball news. St. Albert wins a pair over Thomas Jefferson, reported by Austin Heinen. The St. Albert basketball teams each picked up a win over Thomas Jefferson in a non-conference matchup between city teams. The Saints, 6-10, used big runs in the second and third quarter to run away from the Yellow Jackets, now 0-14, by a score of 54-14. After a close and competitive first quarter, the Saints climbed into the driver's seat and took control after ending the first half on a 16-0 run. St. Albert head coach Dick Wettingel was pleased over how the girls picked up their defensive effort, especially on the defensive glass. "I think Thomas Jefferson did a good job of being aggressive on the offensive boards in that first quarter," Wettingel said. "After that, we really emphasized to the girls not to give up those second and third chance opportunities. It really caught our attention. The girls did a better job of taking that away from them as the game went on. Then it was really about our offense connecting and executing. The Saints weren't done yet, putting the game out of reach with a 21-0 third quarter run, while defensively only allowing the four Yellow Jacket points in the second half. Wettingel hopes this decisive victory builds team confidence for a tough upcoming slate of games. Hopefully, the win tonight will boost our confidence," Wettingel said. "We have two more games coming up in the row, in a trip to Atlantic, and then playing Abraham Lincoln to close the week. We got a tough slate ahead. Our schedule is always a tough one for a Class 1A school, but that's the way we like it. That was the girls' report, and the boys' Falcons complete the sweep. The Falcons, now 7-7, also earned a non-conference win over the Yellow Jackets, who are 0-13, by a score of 85-55. Both teams had no issue scoring in the first quarter, combining for 35 points in the first quarter. However, the Falcons created some separation in the second quarter thanks to a 9-2 run midway through the quarter and another 7-0 run later in the quarter. The Falcons did more of the same in the second half, as St. Albert came out firing on all cylinders, which created a 14-2 run to start the second half, which helped them pull away and get back to 500. Both St. Albert teams will travel to Atlantic on January 29 for their sixth game. The article is accompanied by a picture of Thomas Jefferson's Lane Tolman defending St. Albert's Greg Fagan. And there's also a picture of the girls' game in action, and the caption says, St. Albert's Lena Rosenli shoots over Thomas Jefferson's Taryn Gant during the second quarter on Thursday at St. Thomas Jefferson High School in Council Bluffs. Staff photos were taken by Joe Shearer. The prep roundup column reported by Derek Norin, headline, Prep Roundup, CBAL's Blair wins 200 free at Boys MRC Championship Swim Meet. The Council Bluffs Boys Swimming Team participated in the Missouri River Conference Championship Swim Meet against Sioux City at Sioux City East High School on Thursday. Sioux City won the team competition by a cumulative score of 133-23. Council Bluffs swimmer Tayden Blair was the team's lone event winner, taking first place in the 200 freestyle, finishing in a time of 1 minute 55.67 seconds. Several other Council Bluffs swimmers continued to improve personal times, something head coach Logan Maxwell is encouraged by. We had several personal records and had a great night against a tough Sioux City team, Maxwell said. With Tayden's win, Council Bluffs Abraham Lincoln will have an individual conference champion and members on the first team, all-conference team for both girls and boys in their respective season. Elena Verhiticke and Jocelyn Miller accomplished the feat for the girls' team this fall. This is a huge progress for our program as a whole this year, and I'm super proud of how far they've come, Maxwell said. We have another girls' basketball report. Frontier Conference Tournament Consolation Game, Cornerstone Christian 55, Heartland Christian 37. Sarah Stile scored a team-high 14 points and had 10 rebounds, while Madeline Junt added 10 points and 7 boards, but Heartland Christian fell to Cornerstone Christian of Bellevue, Nebraska, 55-37, in a consolation game in the Frontier Conference tournament on Thursday. Heartland Christian's Becca Rogers also had a productive afternoon, grabbing a team-high 13 rebounds, 6 offensive, while scoring 6 points. Heartland Christian is scheduled to host Cornerstone Christian in a rematch on Monday. At the bottom of the sports page, the front page, let's check out the Nebraska football story from the Omaha World Herald by Dirk Chatelain. It says in the headline, 3 years in, Scott Frost's words don't match reality. You can cite the resume from football heaven. National championship quarterback for Tom Osborne. NFL experience under Bill Parcells and Bill Belichick, mentor to Marcus Mariota and Mackenzie Milton. But the core of Scott Frost's appeal, beyond his impressive connections and statistics, was always something intangible, something visceral, confidence, conviction, certitude. When Frost took over the Big Red in 2017, he calmed 15 years of chaos simply by the way he walked and talked. This was a guy who not only exuded excellence, he cared about Nebraska like his own family, and he spoke the language of his audience. Remember Frost's second loss, Troy, in 2018, when he delivered a pep talk for Husker fans as much as players. If anybody doesn't want to stay on board with this ride with us, let me know now and get off, Frost said, because I know where this is going. He used that phrase over and over the first two seasons. From September 27, 2019, the day before Nebraska hosted College Game Day, "Love where you are as a football team. I can feel where this is going." Again, after that 48-7 loss to Ohio State, the kids know where this is going. The coaches know where this is going. 2 weeks later, after a 34-7 blowout at Minnesota, "I know where this is going. There's going to be ups and downs." November 29, 2019, after an ugly loss at Purdue, "People see where this is going, and we aren't going to lose sight of that." The message worked because it came from Frost, but now, 3 years into his tenure, even Frost's strongest advocates must acknowledge it's hard to know where Nebraska football is going. Hard to see. Losing games is bad enough, but losing scholarship players in droves, too? Last week, Frost restated his belief in the rebuilding process. "I gotta tell you, I've never felt this good about our football team, the culture on our football team, the attitudes on our football team, and the talent level on our football team." 4 days later, three players from his 2020 offense announced they were leaving, surely no surprise to Frost. They followed Wandale Robinson and Derek Mills out the door. You can justify each of these departures individually, but it's hard to justify them collectively. It continues a pattern of Frost's words straining to match the team's actions. Some quotes the past 3 years are easy to remember. "Year two is when it's going to take off around here, and taking off doesn't mean we're going to go undefeated, but we'll be a really good team in 2 years," Frost said in April 2018. "Opponents better get us now because we'll keep getting better," he said in July 2018. You likely remember those remarks, but many others fit the same mold. April 2019, "I have no doubt we're going to be vastly improved. We are getting closer to being a complete team." February 2020, "Maybe for the first time since I've been at Nebraska, I feel like the culture's about there." June 2020, "There's been a lot of roster turnover and a lot of it was necessary. We're getting closer and closer." Youth appears the never-ending obstacle, especially on offense. September 2018, after a 56-10 loss at Michigan, "We ran a bunch of young guys out there. We've got some young guys that are going to be great players, but they have 22-year-olds, and we have 18-year-olds in some positions." October 2019, "We're still playing a lot of young guys, a lot of guys who haven't started a lot." December 2020, "It's not meant to be an excuse, but we're still playing a lot of young guys." The point here isn't to play gotcha with Frost's words. He speaks to the media 3 or 4 times a week. He has to say something. Frost rarely boasts anymore, and even if he did, boldness is part of the fun. Who wants a coach who doesn't say what he thinks? When Frost loses his confidence, Nebraska is even in even bigger trouble. But you don't have to be a critic to notice Frost's credibility within the fan base has slipped the past 12 to 15 months. The coach who inspires such faith now struggles to sell the vision. "There's no question in my mind that we're going to get it fixed," Frost said after the Michigan loss in 2018. "We are going to get it fixed," he said after a 38-31 loss to Indiana in October 2019. This was a fix, and we are in the process of getting it fixed, and it's going to happen, he said, in November 2019 during a four-game losing streak. We're going to get this fixed, Frost said, after a 41-23 loss at home to Illinois in November 2020. I have as much or more confidence today than I've had. Frost still has time. Even if the Huskers produce another losing season in 2021, a sobering thought, he'll almost certainly be back in 2022. We shouldn't forget the generous timetable here. No way Husker fans give up on Frost prematurely. But after 3 years, it's getting hard to hear the same things over and over and believe them. At some point, Frost sounds like the man who cried progress. We are a good enough team to have won several that we lost, Frost said in October 2018. November 2019. With a few plays here and there, the record would be completely different, and this year would be completely different. November 2020. I don't think our record is indicative of where we are right now and the improvements we've made. In December, after a home loss to a Minnesota team missing 30-plus players, Frost reiterated the point. There's been so much progress this year. The record just isn't what we want. Eventually, the record is all that matters. And that was the sports column by Dirk Chatelain of the Omaha World-Herald, and is accompanied by a picture of a profile of Nebraska coach Scott Frost as he watches the Huskers warm up before the start of their game against Northwestern on November 7th of last year. That game was played in Nebraska, in Evanston. On the Lifestyles page, we have a story by Emily Scheib. Presentation by Caleb Rainey, planned at Bluffs Library. The Council Bluffs Public Library will host Caleb Rainey, the Negro artist, over Zoom on February 8 at 6:30 p.m. Rainey is an author, producer, and performer who will discuss race relations with honesty and vulnerability, the library said in a release. The event is part of a series with the library to honor Black History Month and focus on poetry. Originally from Columbia, Missouri, Rainey attended the University of Iowa, where he obtained a bachelor's degree in English with a focus on creative writing. He is the author of two books, Look, Black Boy, which was featured on Iowa Public Radio, and Heart Notes, which was published in October 2020. He co-founded the literary magazine Black Art Real Stories, was published in Iowa's Best Emerging Poets 2019, The Little Village Magazine, and writes a monthly column for The Real Mainstream, the release said. Rainey has had a multitude of titles, including being named Best Poet in Iowa City and Cedar Rapids by Little Village Magazine. He was a winner of the Des Moines Poetry Slam, as well as the Iowa City Poetry Slam. He also won the Fire and Ice Poetry Slam twice, and was a finalist for the UNESCO City of Literature Global Slam, Iowa City, according to the release. He has visited many states, including Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, and Colorado, giving spoken word performances, and has even performed in London, England. Among all this, he has opened for Dan Brown, been featured on the Big Boy Joy album, and has done some acting in Iowa. I think that album should be pronounced Black Boy Joy Album. It is spelled B-L-K-B-O-I, Black Boy Joy Album. When he is not writing and performing, he is actively curating a community of spoken word poets in Iowa City through his creation of a high school program, IC Speaks, and producing local events like Poetry and Motion, the release said. This presentation is free, available in person in meeting room B at the library and over Zoom for those who would like to watch from home. Masks are required for those attending in person, and registration is required since seating is limited. To make reservations or get more information, call 712-323-7553, extension 1:3-2. The article is accompanied by a picture of Caleb Rainey performing poetry, and he's wearing what looks like a nice paisley printed shirt, and he's addressing a microphone with a dark red background. Caleb Rainey at the Council Bluffs Public Library. And we'll finish up with some items from the roundup of legislative and capital news items of interest in what is called the Capital Digest, and this comes from the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. First, protecting ideology. A proposal to add political ideology as a protected class to the Iowa Civil Rights Act was advanced by a House Judiciary Committee panel. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Steve Holt, Republican Denison, called for a serious discussion on the matters of intolerance as it pertains to political ideology. It's necessary because of, quote, cancel culture, unquote, and what he decried as, quote, otherwise credible people are now talking about reprogramming those who do not share their political ideology, unquote. Under HSB 67, political ideology would join race, age, race, color, creed, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, religion, national origin, disability, marital status, and family status as protected classes. The Act prohibits discrimination in employment, wages, public accommodations, housing, education, and credit practices based upon certain characteristics of a person. A person who claims to be aggrieved by an unfair or discriminatory practice prohibited by the Iowa Civil Rights Act may file a complaint with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission. Holt said, "Our nation has thrived since 1776 by being tolerant of opposing views." A second item, requiring cursive. Republicans on a Senate Education Committee Wednesday approved a measure that would require public schools districts to incorporate cursive handwriting instruction in their curriculum with the goal of making students proficient in reading and legibly writing in cursive by the end of third grade. Proponents said there are many benefits associated with the skill, while critics worried it was an unfunded mandate at a time when schools are facing many challenges brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. An official from the State Department of Education said the provision should be a goal rather than a requirement for advancement, and the time devoted to the activity should be determined locally. Senator Jim Carlin, Republican Sioux City, called the bill a conversation worth having and worth continuing. In forwarding Senate File 89 to the full Education Committee. Other items in the list include gay panic defense, permanent daylight saving time, drug test fraud, over-the-counter birth control, common ground, surgical centers, and cocktails to go. Unfortunately, we have no time to address those, but I'm sure those items will come up in later reports about the legislature. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on this Friday, January 29th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.